Remember that your heroes are human. They're just doing really important, simple things consistently every time. And it's not to say that that just makes them basic. It just means that everybody else isn't doing that. And so if you see your hero and you're like, I don't know, I just will never be that guy. Like, I'll just never be that girl. I'll never be that person. Like, that just seems highly unlikely. Well, check your logic. Maybe you have no idea what even got them there, like what keeps them there and like what makes them consistently getting better. And if you try to do that too, who knows? They're just human.
Hey, welcome to the Test Piece Podcast. This podcast is about all things high-level climbing. My name's Joshua Horsley. I've been climbing for 25 years, and I love staying at the cutting edge of climbing.
Hi, my name is Timothy Kang. I'm a pro climber, a coach, and a route setter, and climbing is my life.
We started the podcast to explore and articulate what it takes to climb at a high level, what it takes to go from good to great. Okay, let's start the podcast. All right, Tim, my dude, how's it going, man?
Josh, what's up? It's going pretty good.
Tim, you're back in your closet. You're off mountain time. I'm in my office / guest bedroom. We're back on Pacific time. Good to be back though, man.
Yeah, it's good to be back. Yeah, for me, this is kind of the first traveling I've done, I think, this year, like major time away. Well, I went to the Bay Area, I guess, a couple weeks ago, but that felt like the start of it. And then I came back home for like a very short period of time and then, you know, took off to Salt Lake for 2 weeks. So it's nice to be back. I'm psyched, but I'm tired. I just got back yesterday.
Yeah, dude, you could do all these late night drive. Actually, that wasn't even that late night. That was more normal, but thanks for, getting in the car, showing up at home, hop on the podcast. Cause I'm psyched to pick your brain on everything you saw. Cause you were in Salt Lake City. You were there for the NACS. Is that an NACS Cup? Do they call it a cup also?
I don't know. It's called the North American Cup Series event.
Oh yeah, there. The cup is in the freaking acronym. Okay, whatever. There is a comp, and that comp was still stacked, dude. Still stacked that you end up not competing at. But then, yeah, you saw the Salt Lake City World Cup, which, dude, if you haven't been to a World Cup, you should go to one. Like, it's just like, this is our sport. I don't care if you're not a big indoor climber. Like, it's just fun being around that energy and seeing all those big names up close. So how was it, man? Was it good times?
Yeah. So I didn't go and watch the thing in person. So the NACS was awesome. I did get to watch that in person. Well, I'll tell you why. First of all, if you're listening and you had any idea about the World Cup or you tried to go and watch or anything, first of all, it would have been uninteresting probably because it was at the TC, which was a common thing that people were talking about. A lot of the World Cup competitors were very unhappy about that. And so I'm not trying to throw shade or anything. It's just like, why would you put it in?
Yeah, tell us what
training
the TC
is. Yeah, I think you guys should probably know what the TC is my guess, but
set the stage.
If you don't know,
why it's unimpressive.
If you don't know what the TC is, it's the U.S. Team Training Center in Salt Lake City. It's changed probably over the course of the last 5 years. It's changed probably 3 or 4 times. This one's pretty nice. It's bigger, but you know, they're always kind of in these leased warehouse spaces, you know, kind of dark. World Cups are usually in these like massive stadiums or outside, and they're like pretty cool. The World Cups in Salt Lake City historically were either in these big lots or in parks. Last year was in the park, and honestly, it was pretty cool. Other than some park shenanigans, like Salt Lake City, you know, parks have a lot of homeless people and stuff, and there's a lot of stuff. Like a girl got like almost kidnapped there, which is kind of like horrible. But aside from that, you know, a park is like obviously a much more ideal location to go and watch. Like, you know, a bunch of, you know, you're watching like over 100 badass rock climbing competitors, and just like the way climbing walls work, like you can build them kind of anywhere, at least for the competition. So it makes sense to put it somewhere cool. But for whatever reason, and I kind of know the reasons, but you know, for whatever reason, the World Cup was at the TC. I think a lot of the competitors were like not that psyched on it originally. I think it ended up being a pretty cool vibe. I watched it on the stream, and so that's one reason I didn't go, is because it's at the TC, and the stream is probably better than the viewing that I would get inside the TC. And actually, I really like the streams in general. For the World Cup, other than the commentating, but that's another
whoa,
side.
Whoa, whoa, what do you mean other than the comment? There's some really good commentating there. Well, we'll get into that later, yeah.
Okay, yeah, actually, this one just so happened, I actually had to turn, I had to rewatch it. I actually ended up rewatching it because I didn't watch it with commentating on, I didn't watch it with volume on, and then I rewatched it because I was like, oh, Honnold is commentating, like, this is amazing. The second reason is because they charge $200 for tickets, which is insane for, I mean, a climbing event, but also like for any World Cup that's not usually that expensive, I don't think. So I found that out and I was like, oh, not a chance, I'm gonna try, because I was gonna watch finals or something. But
how much did the competitors win if they were to win?
Sorry, I'm laughing because that's kind of that was my favorite. I wrote a comment on YouTube that was like pretty, it got a lot of likes. Yeah, it was hilarious. People totally might have missed it because it was afterward, where they were kind of doing the podium, and Honnold started asking about how much these competitors make at these competitions. And Matt decided, I guess his answers at first were like, you know, he was being the person I think he should be. I don't think he's the one to want to disclose all that information. But he did say that he didn't know, which is not true. Like, he absolutely knows that stuff. That stuff is very easy information to find if you look for it. I think it's in the rules, like how much people make. But I would say they make on average around $3,000 to $4,000 for first place, depending on the competition. I'm not sure if it's consistent, but I'm pretty sure I read something that it's like $3,000 roughly. Regardless, I mean, in between $3,000 to $4,000, and that's the first place spot. And then beyond podium, I don't think anyone makes any money. So,
dude, I was just talking to someone about this, which, yeah, it was on that Instagram account, Industry Problems, and it was like that hilarious little clip of him just, yeah, asking about the state of our athletes and their ability to sustain themselves and, or the lack thereof of that ability. So I was talking to someone about this, and they told me that they know that in disc golf, you know, disc golf, you know, that mm-hmm. sport. I mean, I don't know. It's a sport. Mm-hmm. It's not in the Olympics. The top guy last year, his winnings were, it was $300,000.
It Dude, was like, oh, just from comps.
Yeah. Just from comps. That's not sponsors. I don't know who sponsors disc golf though. Like beer company, like, I don't
probably
know,
like, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. When I went disc golfing, it's like, are you drinking? Because that's what disc golfing is. But anyways, yeah. Yeah, just kind of a bummer, but what a freaking hilarious thing for Honnold to say. I don't know. There was all these conversations I had with people, and maybe you have some insight, Tim, because I didn't read your comment yet. Do you think that he said this on purpose? Like, was this some kind of hint? Was this him kind trying to change the industry? Or do you think this is just Honnold being the kind of happy-go-lucky, kind of a little head in the cloud? Like, you know, he's got kind of that style, which something that's really lovable about him is I feel like he's just kind of like, I don't know, I'm here. Here's my question versus a tactical thinking. So yeah, what do you think about that?
This was not the only comment that came out of Honnold's mouth that was absolutely just pure logical, like just like a pure logical question. For example, I turned on the speed final stream right afterward, and one of the very first things he said, he was asking, and it's like the way he asks it, you're right, it kind of almost could come off as like, dude, are you asking that to like call out things, or are you like asking because he genuinely cares? And after rewatching most of the stream, I was like, oh wait, he actually is like asking really good logical questions that I think he actually is like genuinely curious about. But I think to answer the industry problems one specifically in terms of the money, I think that when he started to dig more because he was starting to get like, whoa, like what? Because the way that he kind of backed off of it after, where he's like, oh, okay. Like, I think he realized that he was picking on nerves. But for most of the other questions, they seemed very, very like they came from him, like from a very just like logical standpoint. Like, why does it work this way? Like, what is this? Like, what is that? And for speed, this was hilarious to me because I had the same thought like a long time ago, but like, the point is that no one cares to change these things. It's not, they're good questions, you know, like they're super good questions. It's just that like they just happen to not be fixed. But for example, speed competitors are on auto belay for the competitions, for almost every competition nowadays. And they just clip in, right? Like instead of tying in, they just clip you in. Well, the harness where you clip in or tie in is like where that spot is right in front of you, but it's in your way in speed climbing like all the time. And it looks like it. And so the first question he asks is, oh, do they always like put the rope on the right side or like behind the right shoulder? And Matt's like, oh, it's, you know, up for people. He's like, why? He's like, why don't they put it on the back? And Matt was like, I like how Matt kind of gives an answer where it's like, Matt, you didn't really think that one through. It's just like an answer I think you probably give to everybody. But when he said, oh, you don't want them to like flip You don't want them to like flip back forward if the harness is attached to them on the back. Like, I guess if they come off the wall, they'll like flip forward. And it's like, okay. And Honda was like, well, that wouldn't happen if the wall was, or is like, isn't the wall overhung? And Matt, he's like, how overhung is the wall? And Matt's like, oh, it's like 5 degrees. And Honda's like, that's enough for someone to not flip. And he was like, oh, then I don't know, honestly. And the amount of times throughout the entire stream, bouldering and speed, where Alex would, you know, ask a really good question, and then Matt was just basically answer, and like, I actually don't know. And it's like, yeah, I don't think that many people know. Not to throw shade on Matt necessarily, like, I don't think these questions are thought out, you know, like, they're not thought out to be answered. So it's just hilarious.
I mean, that's Arnold coming in and just asking a question as if he was 5 years old. Just, what if you just put it on the back? But then Honnold, we've talked about this before. Sometimes people say Honnold is overrated. They're like, oh, he's not that good. He just, you know, does dangerous stuff. And we've had this conversation. We're like, no, he's underrated. The guy is such a good climber. And he,
that's what I think.
He climbs extremely hard, extremely well. And he's probably put more miles in than 99.9% of climbers. The amount of time that guy's been on real rock just moving is a lot. So hearing someone who just is like asking the dumb, obvious question, but it comes from the mouth of a guy who's both a celebrity as well as an extremely good climber. And I just love it. I love it. Shining a light on some obvious topics.
Yeah. And in addition to that, I think for me, and I wonder if this is like the sentiment that a lot of you guys had, and if you haven't watched the World Cup, because you usually, and I say this probably because I've heard this so many times, but if you didn't watch the World Cup because you're sick of, you know, commentating, that's the main reason why you don't watch it, you should definitely watch this one. I think it was entertaining. I have personal thoughts on a lot of the setting style and whatever it was, but it actually was very entertaining, just the comp itself. But it was also super entertaining, aside from the things we were just talking about with Honnold. He's a real rock climber. You know, he goes out, he's just out all the time, a real rock climber. Like we said, Josh and I think he's very underrated in terms of his climbing ability, his skill and his technique and his strength, because he's just so highlighted in his free soloing. I think people don't remember or look at or try to like think about him being an extremely good rock climber, which I think he is. And because of that, he was asking really good questions about the setting and like, you know, the format, the performance. He was trying to relate to like what climbers actually see if they're not competitive climbers. And I think it's a really good lens, actually. I know a lot of people were like, oh, petition for the most liked comment. My comment in YouTube was the second most liked comment. The most liked comment was petition for Honnold to be a commentator. And it's like, yeah, I mean, if he had not too much better things to do in life, I'm sure he would be down for that because the community would love it. But like, I'm sure he's a super busy guy.
You know what's sad is he would get paid more than all of the athletes' purses combined. And on top of that, he already makes more than all of the athletes combined, including all their sponsors. I mean, with that said, I would argue that Honnold has done a lot for climbing. And even though it's kind of like this trope where you meet someone and you're like, yeah, I climbed. They're like, oh, do you know Honnold? You're like, God damn it. Like, he's just one guy. Like, it's, you know, he's done a lot to bring climbing into the mainstream. And I would argue that actually he is a great ambassador. And that total kind of honest thing that he did in the commentating, when you see him on stuff like Joe Rogan or whatever, he is that same dude. He is just this honest, right there guy. And so, yeah, I would love to see him as a commentator. Tim, I got to tell you, I keep teasing this because I know it's not public yet, but for all those complaints about the IFSC style and the purses and everything, there's new stuff coming down the pipe, man. Let's just say, I think that in the next 5 years, IFSC will not be the only game in town. And so, you know, whatever we're kind of railing against, the whole community is railing against it a little bit too. And, I'm not going to say terrible things about the IFC. We can poke fun at them and like, yeah, you know, of course, like they're the only game in town, so we can kind of make fun of them. But I'm excited to see what's coming down the pipeline. There's going to be more fun stuff to watch as a spectator and for pros to compete in.
Totally. I will say, it's interesting to me because I would say in the last decade that I've noticed competition climbing, there was a shift. There was a lot of outlet for a different style of competition. There were different people hosting different competitions. For example, like Seco Block, there was like multiple different types of Seco Block events. There's multiple different types of, I mean, there's been like Arco Masters, Rock Masters for a long time, which is like a lead race. There's been the TBF Masters, in my opinion, was like one of the best different outlets for a different style of competition climbing. Adidas Rockstars is a very different one. What I think is going to be different, though, with the new outlets coming out as time goes on, is we're finally at a place where, as a community, we probably understand that IFSC setting isn't necessarily exactly what is true to what real climbing maybe should be testing. And so that's something that I think has been in the air for a long time. But now maybe as a community, we're starting to understand that that's, yeah, maybe not super appropriate to be like the most highlighted competition series.
Well, we can only hope that there's new stuff coming, because this thing that top athletes always point out is that it's so surprising that if you walk into the gym, no one would even have known that there was a World Cup going on. Like, why is that not a big buzz? Like, you would think that, yeah, you know, if there's the Game 7 playoff going on right now and you were playing pickup basketball, everyone would be talking about that. And I know climbing's different, and what comes next probably won't be quite as cool as that anyways, but just an opportunity for, I always love seeing the sport grow.
Totally.
Who knows what comes out of it? Maybe it is badass. Like Seco Block was pretty cool. And I feel like that had some staying power. So yeah, looking forward to the next generation of comps.
Do you kind of like, you know, kind of made fun, I know you weren't, but really, but you know, kind of making fun of me for not going to actually watch this World Cup, even though I'm in town, you know, not watching this World Cup in person. I'm like, do you said it yourself, man? Like, why would I go watch it? I have no problem telling people like, nope, I have zero interest to go and watch this event. You know, like I was actually, to be fair, I was coaching Vail on those days anyway. I wouldn't have been able to go and watch these events, and I was very tired like when it was happening, and don't mind watching the stream. But I also just have no interest to go and watch these events. But 5 years ago, I did. I would drop everything to go watch Nationals.
Well, also, you were in the TC. You got to see some of these athletes. You got to climb with them. And so it wasn't like you weren't totally divorced from the event in its entirety. You just didn't go to the actual main event because, yeah, $200 is no joke. That's like, how much does a Game 7 playoff for basketball cost? Like $200 seems like a lot of money to go to a little TC World Cup event. I shouldn't be ripping
on it. What are the stakes? Like, what are the stakes? I want to watch someone compete for thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars, not... Like, you know, it's not even a part of the thing. Like, what are the stakes? Like, I want to be interested, you know? I actually personally get very frustrated and angry watching competitions, so it's not worth it for me to go and pay.
Wait. I mean, Tim, the stakes are being a gold medalist in a World Cup. I mean, having that in your resume or back pocket, when you look back over your life, you're going to still be psyched. So there's still some stakes there, Tim.
For sure.
All right. Tim's like, okay, we won't go down that rabbit hole. Okay. Tim, we were just climbing together. You and me, dog. It had been a minute too. And it was really fun. I don't want to tease too much about what we have come down the YouTubes, but we did a video collaboration with another company that was really enjoyable and fun. And at least half the fun was getting to climb with you, Tim. And I'm just going to put you on the spot. Tim, what is the one thing you remember about my climbing that I should do better? Like what stood out in your head? I mean, I know we were just climbing together. We were just having a blast, having fun. And so I'm not so sure you had your coach hat on, but is there anything that you remember that you're like, damn, Josh really sucked at that? Something like that.
Yes, of course. No. That's actually a really hard question because not to just toot your horn, but it actually surprised me in the opposite way. Josh was in incredibly good shape. He seemed to have been, in my opinion, a very different climber than I had watched him previous years in a lot of the things that we had been talking about previously. Like a lot of the things that I've seen improvement in were just like subtle things that we try to talk about on the podcast, like just usage of mechanics, trust and reliance, creativity and beta, you know, a positive mindset on the wall, like all of it was there and better than me. And it gave me a lot of good insight into things that I should be coming back to practice on. It's hard, I think. Yeah, and this gave me a lot of insight as well for me personally in my journey back in climbing, because I've had, 4 or 5 months essentially of like barely any climbing, barely just maintenance of psych, honestly. Like, I haven't even thought about the physical maintenance of it, to be honest. Just the maintenance of psych. And that's just being vulnerable. But then to kind of take that, go to Salt Lake City after, or like, you know, go back and forth, have some access to climbing, coming back here, having some more access to climbing, and like, you know, having the time to push myself into it. I've just been thinking about a lot of stuff that I saw Josh do really well, which is like the only things that are really important. And that kind of goes into a lot of like what we want to talk about, I think, later in the meat of our topic today. But yeah, a lot of just good stuff. I do have a small critique if you want it.
Dude, lay it on me. Because I'm sure, I mean, I'm asking this selfishly because in general, Tim, it's just great to get to pick your mind as a coach about the things I struggle with. And I mean, even though I would do that if we were just, you know, like if you weren't a coach, I would still ask you the same thing, but you know, you've seen a lot. And so yeah, lay it on me because I'm sure it's not just me that has this issue and it'll be applicable for everyone.
There were some interesting, this could be kind of subjective, but to me, there were some interesting beta reads that I heard from you. Like when we would just look at the wall, and like some things that you would say hard no to, or like you're going to do something else. To me, they were rooted in reliances. Some of those things were rooted in things that you like versus things that were effective. That is like actually the literal only critique I could have given. And that to me is actually a pretty big one when you're a good climber. And like, I would say that I would work on it with you if you were a competitive athlete. If you're a competitive athlete, that is like one of the most important attributes, is being able to read properly and like being able to not have your reliances or your biases change what you think you're supposed to do. There's a difference between what you think you should do, and then once you pull on the wall, like changing that information, which I think is then okay, appropriate to have some biases. But honestly, the most important thing is to be able to read a climb neutrally and not saying like, oh, but I really like full crimping, and so I'm going to grab this foothold instead and do this other thing. That's after you see all the options. And yeah, there was just like, I mean, I think you probably remember some things. Yeah.
Ah, that's good. It's funny because we talk about this all the time, and I consider myself open to beta, but I think one of the reasons why I was doing that too is I was there to try to send, you know, to try to do my best. And so I was definitely picking beta. I was not in training mode whatsoever. I was just thinking to myself, I think this is the way. But then there's also this side thing where when you're not open, then you may be wasting some tries, trying to do the wrong thing or getting too stuck into the beta that you think is going to work and trying extra, extra hard 3 times in a row when really you should have just been looking around you. I'll be curious. When we have the footage, I actually want to know which climbs these are because maybe I am just blind. I don't remember. And because nothing does jump out into my head as being specifically like, oh, Josh, you were hard headed. I'm not saying but that's actually the point. Like, that's the point you're making, is that we become, or I'm blind. Like, I don't even know what you're talking about, actually, Tim. Like, it doesn't. And so just that worries me, right? Like, that worries me.
Yeah. Maybe off air, I'll pull up specifically where, like, for example, like Josh would say, like, oh, that, like, this heel hook looks like, oh, you can't do it that way. I was like, I didn't even read a heel hook. Like, I didn't even think I was going to do that. That would be like an example of something that happened like twice, and then pretty much none other time. But it's like, that's actually a common one. Mm-hmm. People will do that often. It'd be like, oh yeah, like that, you see that like heel hook? I'm like, nope, I don't. Like, I see a heel hook could be possible, but I didn't see that as effective for the movement.
We should do that on air or do something separate where it's the video. Cause I just think that's the really important part of visualizing and understanding as you walk up to a climb. Like,
totally,
these things that jump out at you because of your history, like maybe be careful when it jumps at you. Like I do. And I love heel hooking, Tim. I love heel hooking. And yeah, it was interesting because we were avoiding certain moves because of your injury. And so they jumped at me. I was like, oh no, like you can't do that. And they weren't even, I don't think I heel hooked on them either. And that is
right. My one pushback,
Tim, is that I often will look at things, read a few things, and even when I have, I'm like, oh, it's a heel hook, I often am able to pretty quickly get on the wall and be like, oh, it's not a heel hook. But, you know, and be willing to change my path right in the moment. So,
yeah. And that's why I said it was a reading thing, not so much a decision-making thing, because I definitely don't think you had, like, when you pulled on, like, we both would just, like, very quickly do what we, and that's why it's so interesting. Like, climbing is interesting where you look at a climber's intuitive ability, where it's just like, oh, you just pull on and do the best. And most often that's better than their ability to read. Like, I actually don't know that many people in the entire world that I've seen who are better at reading climbing than intuiting climbing. And so it's not a major weakness at all. It's just, like I said, it's actually only really important, in my opinion, for competing, because otherwise there's not that many factors that matter.
Well, I would say that reading is something that I was never super great at. I've always been really intuitive, but I distinctly remember hitting a ceiling where my body didn't know. Yeah, I had a lot of background as a kid. I did gymnastics. And so I was able to trust my intuition. I didn't want to say I was able to trust my intuition. That was just how I climbed there. And to be fair, there wasn't a lot of coaching back then or thinking about this. So I just climbed. And as time went on, I realized that just because something didn't show up to me and just because it didn't feel right, didn't mean that it was not appropriate. I needed to push my comfort zone, try things that maybe didn't first appear to me. And I'm sure we've all had this experience. And it's a really interesting experience where someone tells you the beta, you get on there, it feels awful, and then you do the move. And you're like, oh shit. Well, what do I know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think it's this part of climbing for me is like actually one of the most interesting. And I've been like forced in my entire climbing life, pretty much since I very started. From my first couple of months, I got straight into competitions. By choice, I was offered it and I was like, yes, like I want to, this sport is awesome already. Like, of course I want to compete. And I learned right away that competing was kind of about like your first couple tries. And, you know, your first couple tries, basically, like for me, because I think it was so much, there was only a couple competitions I could do a year and they were very, very important to me for lots of different reasons. And to go to an event, have your best try and not be good enough, usually because of read. Actually, it's almost always it was because of read, where like you told yourself you're going to do something, you felt it in the moment, you probably made some adjustments and it didn't work out your way. And you do that process over and over and over again and usually disappoint yourself. Usually you quote unquote fail. And then you're like, why? Like, what is it in me that always picks the wrong thing or see something a little bit too late or I react to it and I pick the wrong decision? Like literally for me, it was almost always those things. And still to this day, if I'll coach a younger competitive athlete, they do the same thing. And so I had to teach myself and teach others, like, how do you read properly, right? And it's like your ability to understand what your body's actually going to do and actually going to feel in those moments. And then tell yourself that over and over again and have knowledge of climbing holds, friction, positions, being tired, like being excited, knowing those things, anticipating it, and then making a plan, that is super, 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 super difficult. So I just wanted to kind of like say, like, you know, kind of protect the critique is like, dude, that is a very, very, very difficult thing to do. And I don't even think it's that important, but I've been through it, you know, a bunch of times. And for me, it was very important. And at a certain point, yeah, I got really comfortable. And still to this day, I could tell you very comfortably that I could not tell myself, like, all right, Tim, this is exactly what you're going to do. This is exactly what you're going to feel like at this moment. And this, the decision's going to make, I just try to do that. And every time you try to do that, you learn more and more about yourself. And that's what makes climbing for me very fun.
Yeah. I think reading is super, I actually do think it's super important. And I don't know, I'm taking that critique to heart because I you've seen me do these little videos on the moon board where I'm going to try a flash and I say like three different ways I think I can do it. And I am still stunned, especially on the moon board where there's really not that. I mean, there may be literally three handholds on the wall. Let's say four handholds. You know, just there's not that many ways something could happen. And then I will still completely miss an option. And dude, I've been doing it for a, been doing it for a minute. So no, it's something that I'll take to heart. And it makes me think of the, did you see the Adam Ondra video where he went to some crag in France, some random amazing European limestone crag, which is just what Europe is like. And he was like, oh, I want to do some onsighting. And so he tried to onsite all the hard routes there, and big surprise, he did. He onsite basically everything. One of the ones that was the craziest was that he warmed up by onsiting a 14A. Like it's that's. And he was like, oh, I got pretty pumped. He's like, I didn't mean to get so pumped. I don't like getting so pumped during my warm-up. I was just like thinking to myself,
sad.
Yeah, that's rough, dude. Poor guy. And mm-hmm. I've seen some people warm up on some hard stuff, but on-site 14A warm-up is quite a feat. But it consistently blows my mind seeing top route climbers on-siting at very difficult levels and doing it so well, especially on rock. And I don't know what it's like in competition, especially in today's competition style, but onsighting 514 on rock is wild, because if you're onsighting 512, there's often many, many ways to do the climb. And you can grab, there's feet all over. You can grab almost anything. When you start dealing in the 514s, well, actually, I've only climbed on like one 514, so I shouldn't say, but even like in 13s, there's often just one or two sequences that actually work, and the ability to read it and commit and execute just blows my mind. Even if we're talking like, oh, it's just like a V8. Yeah, but like if you're blind on the V8 and you're pumped and there's only one way to do it, like I just don't understand how he pulls that off. It's really impressive.
Yeah, performance is really interesting in climbing, where like when we're talking about this kind of more the more physical things that are important, like the right beta and the endurance aspect, like that alone, to be able to on-site climb that difficulty is already pretty insane. But then to not get affected mentally when things kind of go wrong, like lead climbing, especially on-sites, is a compilation of your errors, right? Not affecting you. What you're capable of is what you're capable of. If you're capable of climbing a 15D or whatever, like your on-siting ability is technically 15D, right? It is. But the reason why you wouldn't do that is because of a compilation of errors, right? And then how those errors affect you and then change the quality of the next decisions that you're going to make. And chances are, by the time you get towards the top of something, you're going to make way more errors than you did at the start of it, right? And so when you see someone like Andre on-site, it's like, how does a guy not make that many errors? And if he makes an error, how does it not affect him? You know, because like everybody who has tried to onsite something difficult, it's like you just start getting tired, but not physically, mentally. You know, you start getting tired mentally. I've only flashed I haven't even tried to onsite that many routes. Like I actually have never even tried to onsite that many routes for whatever reason. I think, you know, I haven't been to many outdoor crags, and usually when I go, I try to hop on classics, and then, you know, people give me beta and spray. And I went to Lander 2 years ago with the BD team, and I happened to flash my first 514, first and only. And it was so hard. Like it was super impressive to this entire like BD athlete team. Like I'm just trying to tell you for the context of how impressive like onsighting 514 and plus is. Like most of them were extremely shocked. They were like, whoa, like we don't even see 14 flashes all the time. And I was shocked. I was like, I did not expect to do that. Like that was like second to last route of the day. Like we were barely gonna, I was just gonna pull on to like feel the move so I could try this climb again when I came back. And I barely did it, you know, like I barely flashed this thing. But in all reality, it's like a long V10. Like it's kind of what the route was. And I was like, dude, could you imagine? I literally remember talking about after, I was like, can you imagine some like onsighting something like that? Like the amount of perfect beta you kind of needed. I had such a good spray. Like this route was crazy, where it's like 45 feet tall. Most of the business is in like the first 30 feet, and there's a rock behind it, Rodeo Free Europe in Lander. And you can walk basically like at the same height as all the moves. So you can see all the holds, you can see all the feet. Like when you can't see all that stuff, man, like I just can't reiterate this enough. It changes your mental game so much to like not know exactly what to do and like not feel good on it. Yeah.
Yeah. Flashing and onsighting are a big difference. And by the way, onsighting's fun, dude. You gotta
it's book super
that
fun.
that ticket to Europe Limestone. I haven't done much projecting on lead, but I have done quite a bit of on-siting, just cruising to some random Amazing. Place and just holiday living of just climbing as much as you can. And yeah, having that spray down, I was in Turkey at this place called Çitibi, and I had a guy spray me down. It was Walker Emerson. I think we've
he's one of the best at spraying.
The best spraying, but it has, it's a cliff. By the way, you should, everyone listening, Çatıbı in Turkey, one of the coolest cliffs ever. And there's an awesome Petzl Rock trip video on it, but it's a massive blue limestone wall, slightly overhanging. And there's a rock that comes up just like what you're talking about all the way. And Walker's just sitting on the top, like talking to me. He was only, 15 feet away or 20 feet away. And it's just so funny hearing that, like, okay, put your toe there. No, just 2 inches to the right. Yeah, you see that? Okay, yeah. Now rock over. And I was just like, we always talk about how a coach can't marionette you, that you're on your own. Walker marionetted me. He was this thing. Dude, by the way, just shout out on James Caro wedding present. Actually, because we were talking about James Pearson last time, this was an FA of him, of his, James Caro.
Oh, cool.
His wife was Caro. Anyways, I'll link a picture in the notes because it is one of the most beautiful climbs I think I've ever been on in my life. It's just perfect 2 foot tugging.
Amazing.
Tim, I was asking you about critiques of me on the board climbing, and now
we're in Turkey.
We're in Turkey, getting Walker yelling at us. Something I do want to ask you more about is, like, you kind of alluded to this. You said seeing me climbing, and thank you for tooting my horn that I climbed well. I told you I tried really hard, and I prepared for it. But also, I just wanted to share what I saw in you that is, I don't have critiques, man. I'm sorry. I didn't really think that way. Just, it wasn't in my head, but I just saw this thing that I always forget about in high level athletes, where you do a move. Like, I remember you stick in the sloper and the cut was heinous, and I just saw your face. And it's that you see someone swing out and they keep kind of scorpioning, or they call it collision fracturing. Thanks, Nathaniel Coleman. Collision fracturing. But there's that extra little 3 degrees on the swing that goes a little bit further. You start chicken winging and you have to really hold on. And I just remember seeing your face, and I was like, oh, Tim's fucking trying hard. This is hard. Yeah. Like, just bringing it out, like, there it is. And it's just this reminder. We've done whole podcasts on this. To do hard climbs, you have to try hard. There's technique and, but one of those deep mental frames that you must have is that you really have to give it your all. And I just remember seeing that and be like, all right, there it is.
That was really Tim. Fun. That moment was pretty fun. Cause yeah, for me, I don't know, every session is like that. I don't climb, I actually really don't pull on too much without having that, especially if there's a move that, like, then becomes pretty distilled to just effort. Like, there's not too much that I could have fixed there. Like, I could have tried to keep my foot on, but it was my injured leg, and like, that's something that my leg doesn't really do anymore. So I was like, okay, like, let's not focus on that. Let's focus on this other thing, which is exactly opposite of how I coach. But it's like, it's just where am I at right now? It's funny that you say you weren't looking for critiques. You don't have any, because I had a million, like, after that session. Myself, and not a negative way, it didn't affect me in that way. I was just like, cool, like, let's work on a lot of these things. But beyond the critiques and beyond things that I could have worked on, one thing that I can only do, like, as where I am physically and like the amount of time that I've been spending climbing and like the amount of fitness that I have or whatever, all I can focus on is effort. And it's been super helpful. It's been very refreshing to like just treat climbing that way, because I actually am very too critical of myself and like too critical of others. It doesn't make it very fun. And it was nice to like not be able to have that much critique. And it was the environment too. Like, we were there just having a lot of fun and trying to just like try whatever climbs. But yeah, man, thank you for that. I definitely was just trying to like bring that out to even this other guy I was coaching for the last week, Vale. Like, I'm like, that's one of the only things we should be really remembering on every attempt is like, was that everything you could do? And like, was it focused on the correct things? And it's more of a question than like, it's just a question.
Yeah. Like what you said, that environment too, we did a lot of volume. We climbed a bunch, and the environment was so fun and supportive. That's, yeah, if you want to bring out the best in yourself, surround yourself with people who want to do the same thing for themselves and want to see you do it too. I told you, Tim, I wanted to you know, I wanted to be in the mix, you know, trying to climb as hard as you did or beat you on things. And I say this, like, people might hear that and think like, oh, like, aren't you and Tim buddies? It's like, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Like, exactly. That's like the best part.
So good stuff. I got to tell you, I was a little beat up from, I didn't hurt myself or anything. I was just like, oh, you know, I put out for it. I was like, okay, I'm tired now. Yeah. So I'm switching gears, and that's my pro tip is I knew we had this date that we were going to climb a lot together and climb and try to climb hard. And I was feeling kind of beat up for the couple of weeks before as well. So I said, I was just feeling beat up after, of course, because we did a lot of volume. It was no joke, but I was feeling kind of beat up the couple of weeks before. And I was so tempted to keep on pushing. And then I probably would have gotten hurt, or I wouldn't have showed up at peak physical performance. And I deloaded, you know, it's this classic thing. It's overreach, you know, kind of overtrain, you know, and then let your body build back up so that you, you know, do a super compensation, right? It's like, if you're 100% baseline, if you keep beating yourself down and now you're at 92%, your body comes back and gives you 102% because it's repairing. It's, you know, that's how training works. Just that simple. And so I did it, man. I was tired for a few weeks and I just kept cutting volume because I'd show up for a session. I just wasn't that psyched. And I'd like have a session and I just wouldn't feel that great. And there is a lot inside of me that said, keep pushing, Josh. Like, this is the home stretch. But then the other voice was, all you could do right now is get hurt. Like, you're not going to get stronger in a week. It's just, you could get hurt though, but you're not going to get stronger. And so I took that to heart. I mean, I've known this for a while, but it's just always remembering these lessons over and over again. So I pulled back, and the week before, Tim, I climbed maybe like three times, but they were mellow, dude. They were just, I like warmed up three times.
Dude, I got basically wrecked right before I went because I just happened to go to Salt Lake City. And not to say that I don't think my climbing was like that affected, other than like my skin hurt so bad like when we started. And it was the first time I pulled on a board this entire year. And so that's just like the most aggressive type of climbing. And so I had that kind of opposite experience. But because of that, I definitely want to like anchor your point down. But yeah, man, I showed up to Salt Lake City, I think 3 days before that or 4 days before that. And I had two sessions. I had a session at BP for like 4 hours. And I thought I was going like chill on the body, but it just didn't end up that way. Afterward, I was like, wait, I am wrecked for this session. I'm screwed. And so my entire climbing life has been like that, where I have these events that have saved dates. And they're usually pretty important for me for whatever reason, and to treat your climbing and training in accordance to that. So I've had probably 50-50 of them that go well and 50-50 of them that don't go well. And usually what doesn't go well is like an improper deload, or like a bad case of decision-making the whole week beforehand, like having three quote unquote chiller sessions, but we know that they weren't chiller. And I'm just going to like, I have a different pro tip later, but that's a really good pro tip to have, is like, pick some important events. Like, you know, this was a video that we shot where we're just going to go and climb on a board, but it was important to you. And it was important that you showed up in this way. And so like, maybe the event itself wasn't that important in all actuality, but to you, it was very important. And you treated your climbing according to that. And I think that's really, really important for climbers to like understand at least what it takes to deload. I don't think you have to live your whole year like that, but it gives you so much insight.
Yeah. The big joke is, you guys were like, oh, dude, Josh, you kept up. It's great, dude. Looked strong. I said, dude, I've been training for like 3 months for this. And I showed up to be the best I could. Tim flies in, doesn't sleep, skin is wrecked. And yeah, it's just like another day. I mean, I think that's, I took it seriously and I'm happy I did. It actually, one of the reasons to have these scheduled things, whether they're trips or whatever it is because otherwise I wouldn't have been climbing hard the last 3 months. I would have been kind of,
yeah,
you know, listless. And so, you know, having this on the calendar forced me to overreach. And then, you know, deloading is something that I've done more often in these little micro things where, you know, hey, this Saturday I'm going to the cliff, or I'm going to see this boulder. I'm going to make sure that I have 2 days that are like really mellow before. I'm going to take my rest. But I don't think I ever have really done a good job where I know I have a big, maybe it's like a week or maybe it's like a month long trip. I don't know. I usually didn't wow. deload for those because I mean, for one thing, I was your age, I'm 25 and like 2 days off. I'm like, well, dude, I'm going to be on a plane for a day. So I'll be fresh when I show up, which is not how it actually works. No. But I think that one of the things that it showed me also is that you can train hard and you will get some signals like, hey, you're pushing hard and you're tired. And so just having, so basically what I did is I went through these three phases. I went hard and then I was tired, actually tired, not just like, oh, I need a good night's sleep. And then I had a good performance day. And I think the more you do that on a little bit broader of a time scale than 3 days, the more you get this indication of, okay, this is what it feels like to be, I say overtrained, but that makes it, overtrained sounds bad, but overtrained is something you need to do. You need to stretch yourself. So I felt that overtraining and now I have a little signpost in my head like, oh, I know what this is like. Oh yeah, you need some rest, dude. And I rested for a while and I had a good day. And so just kind of, yeah, having those little signposts in your head like will help me in the future when I set up for a big trip or something.
Yeah. No, it is super, super cool. And I will say, because not to say that this is not good advice, because it absolutely is, but not everybody should train like this all the time is something that I definitely want to say, because for a lot of people, skill development is probably more important. Just sheer volume is probably more important. But for Josh, you know, I just really want to clean this up and say, like, for Josh to train in this specific way for a specific thing with as much skill that he has developed over his years of climbing, it seemed to work really, really well for him. Like, the guy outclimbed me on almost everything that day, and it was pretty sick to watch. And not only outclimbed me, but looked physically like more capable of just like feeling fresh, more physically capable of like holding any position. Like, yeah, I think I tried really hard, and I think that is where I am very good there. But man, I was feeling like I had to keep up with this guy the entire time. And I'm sure that made me feel pretty good. That was that was really, really fun.
plus one for the old guys. All I had to do was dedicate 3 months to it. But I do. There's something you said there that I want to highlight is that I just talked about overreaching, deloading, then performing. And you said this isn't for everyone. And I want to double down on that statement, because something that I think is a misnomer around overtraining and people talking about overtraining is when you're new to climbing, and by new, it could be 5 years, 3 or 5 years. I think that there's a lot of people who can't overtrain. They're not, I hate to use the word good enough because, well, you're talking about skill development. So if you don't have good enough skills at climbing, it's hard for you to dig yourself into a deep physical rut. And the reason why I say that is that in a microcosm of, say, the squat, you know, really simple movement, if you are really technically proficient at the squat and you can squat, you know, a lot, you're a competitive squatter, you can squat a lot. When you really try hard, you are tapping into things that a brand new person squatting can't. And now you can go and be a pretty new squatter and get really, really sore and it feels awful, but you're just not quite able to dig yourself into a hole like someone who's very experienced at it is. The only caveat I have there when it comes to newish climbers, Tim, I'm sure you've seen this a million times, is people get finger injuries around the 2 to 3 year mark unbelievably reliably. They climb, they can climb a lot. They get psyched, they're climbing a ton, and like they aren't that tired and overtrained because they just, you can climb every day on, you know, V2 and V3 when you're just kind of beginning. Your skin hurts and you're tired, but you can do it. And then your tendons are not healing as fast as your muscles. And so that's the one caveat I have there with everything I'm saying is that if you're newish to climbing and you're doing all the time, just be so careful when you start really crimping hard right around that 2 or 3 year mark, pop, pull it. Just, I mean, you've seen it before, Tim, I'm sure.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, that was me as well. I think another way to look at this in like kind of simple terms, and the way that I've seen it for my entire life of climbing, is if you're going to go and perform, you know, like overtraining is something that people are really actually, I think, like people talk about it in this like, oh, that's maybe not so good. But also almost everybody likes overtraining in something because it feels like if you overtrain in something, you're going to get the obvious gains from it. And a common thing in coaching is that it's really easy to make someone tired. Like I've heard Josh say this too. It's way too easy to make someone tired. It's super easy to make yourself tired. You can do that if you want to, but instead of making yourself tired, you know, get some gains. Like what are the gains that you want to see? It's like, well, what do you want to perform at? Like, okay, you want to send rock climbs? Like we got to figure out how to send rock climbs. Like, well, so whatever you're overtraining in, if that is not actually going to get you whatever you want to get in sending your rock climb, that's a waste. It's a huge waste. And you're just picking the reliances that are probably not effective to getting you your send.
Tim, I want to rant a little bit here, and I hope you'll support me on it. Please give me some rant support here. Tim, it is so easy. And I have said this before. Coaches can make you tired. And oh, hey, Joe, go do 1,000 pull-ups. Okay, coach. Wow, I'm really tired. And you said you want to make gains. And I just want to make sure that what people are hearing is not, do not hear what Tim says as, and look, coach, my pull-ups are better. I'm stronger at pull-ups. It's like, no, like that is
not what I'm saying.
It's coaches can make you tired. But you're not looking to get tired. You're looking to get better. And Tim, here's where my rant's going to keep on going is I've been seeing stuff on the interwebs, and I feel like there's a similar message to what we often have been saying over the past couple of years around, you know, it's the mental game. You know, mental is really important. Focus on this stuff. Mm-hmm. It's not just about hangboarding or whatever in your metrics. I don't know if we were the ones who – I'm not going to say we were the ones who started pushing that pendulum. It may just be a natural thing. And I see coaches saying this, right? It's like, great. And then you go and you contact them and you get your training plan from them and it's 1,000 pull-ups. I swear to God, it's like they say this stuff, but I just want to emphasize it again and again. Getting tired is not the goal. Getting better at the thing that you got tired at is not the goal. I would say that getting better at climbing is the goal, the North Star. But I guess if you just told me that all you wanted to do was 1,000 pull-ups, maybe that's the right training for it. But that's my – I do not want to confuse these issues because it's really tempting still to this day for me to find comfort in repping out pull-ups at the end of a session and think that – it's really, this happens in normal life too. It's easy to be busy. It's hard to move the needle on what's actually important. And do not confuse the two. Do not spin your wheels. And, it's a forever question for us that I think we're always diving into is, okay, like, great, I get it. But what should I, where do I put my efforts to move the needle? And it's not simple. And that's why we're here, because it's not simple.
Yeah. And that's, I think, the most complex part about that. And just to like validate your rant, like, yeah, I've been screaming at the ocean for a really long time about this stuff. Just to also validate if you're listening, like, yeah, what then? Like, what am I supposed to do? Like, Tim, I've seen Tim do pull-ups. Like, Tim can do tons of pull-ups. Like, he's so strong. Like, it's like, yeah, but, you know, that's not what I find important. Like, I just do those things because I acknowledge that there are important factors about them, but I don't believe in them. Like, I don't believe that the pull-ups amount to the specific quote unquote gains that I think are effective to sending. Like, I don't use pull-ups, push-ups, bench press, or any of that stuff to, draw a line from, oh, those gains are going to amount to other things. I've done too much training and too much work and then lost an event. I've done too much of all that stuff, all sorts of training, even way more complex than that, way more technical than that, and still lost an event. You know, my job as an athlete, in my opinion, is to find the answers. And actually, it's how I coach younger athletes. It's like, your job is not to, you know, prove anything to anybody to go and win a comp. No, it's for you to study your sport, find the answers as to what you're going to need to do to get better at it, right? Because that's really difficult. And then train. Like, for me, training is a given. Training is just a given. Just do it. Like, you don't have to do it, but it probably will just help you to do it. We don't have to find, we can't use those metrics and those answers, those gains, to then tie it to that end result that you want to have. That doesn't work that way. I've never seen it work that way. Well, I've seen it work that way on accident. And that's also what's confusing, is that some people do gain gains, right? Metric gains, and then send their project. And that's just the classic example of using results to then change your plan, or, you know, to direct your process based on the result. Is that we never, ever, ever use result in that way. You know, it just happens to be a result.
I think it's a Warren Buffett quote. I don't even know if you know who Warren Buffett is, Tim.
Yeah.
It's okay. Some famous investor. And I think I'm going to attribute this to him, and that's fine if it's someone else. He said, the worst thing that can happen to a budding investment professional is that they get rewarded for the wrong thing on their first trade. So they make a trade for a bad reason, and then it goes up 10x. They go, oh, I know what I'm doing. And it's so, yeah. And this is part of my rant around weightlifting, and this love of weightlifting is, I love weightlifting. But if you tell me that your squat going up made you climb harder, then the reason why it may be the case is if you are so physically detrained that a squat helps your climbing, well then yeah, maybe training is a really important part of your repertoire of things to get you better at our sport. But, you know, as like a athlete, you know, I guess also, Tim, I guess we're not so interested in telling people how to go from V1 to V3, you know,
right.
That's not,
can I,
sorry,
can
go
I
ahead, go for it.
What you just said for the squat, like if the squat happens to be a large empty spot for you physically, and then that makes things, you know, better for you in climbing, that's a good thing to do. But it's that thing that you just said. It's actually that process of saying, if this helps this, then it's something good to do. That is where people make the mistake. Using results is fine, I think, but to rely on that, right? Let's just say you go in, this is the common one. I've heard the Warren Buffett one before, but for me, the most common one that I hear is actually in gambling. Like, maybe it's because I live in Vegas or something, but the worst thing that can happen to someone who's into gambling is to win on their first bet. Right. That's by far the worst thing to do. That's absolutely, because you have no idea what's going to happen. And you think the result that you got justifies every other thing, choice that you're going to make after that. You think that result is something you're supposed to expect. No, every decision that you make is individual to the decision that you make. So you can sometimes use the result to be like, oh, interesting. Like, that's how often you might win, like in this game. Like, that's how often you might lose in this game. So for example, if you use the squat to say like, oh, interesting, this time I did squatting for 2 weeks and it felt easier in this exact way, in this type of movement, and I liked that. You can't say like, oh, I squatted, squatting is good for climbing. Like, I got better at squatting, I set my project, squatting is good for climbing. That's what I hear too much. I hear this over-reliance and oversimplification of results to say that this grants me something. I don't like that. What I like to hear is, okay, saw a result. It was interesting that it had factors that changed how I did something, right? That's research. If you really want to get better at something, you have to research. You have to experiment. You cannot say, this means this, so I must do this. It's like, that's just so like one note, you know, it's so simple. And so that's why the rant for me is like, it's very strong. I've been thinking and talk about this for years at this point.
I also want to say again, I actually really, really like weightlifting, and I'm not super anti-weightlifting.
Yeah,
but
me too.
You know, me and Tim are looking at just what it takes to get better, and it is not a foregone conclusion that squatting more will make you better at climbing. Period. That is not a foregone conclusion. It could. And what I see, Tim, that just blows my mind is the mental gymnastics people go through when they focus on weightlifting. Often they bulk up too, you know, they put on 15, 20 pounds. And, you know, I don't want to make this a discussion about the weight, because if you tell me that you're sport climbing, whatever, bouldering, and you put on some weight and you're climbing great, it's like, well, why are we even talking about the weight? Who cares? If you're climbing good, go for it. But you see these mental gymnastics where people focus on a bunch of heavy lifting they bulk up, and then they talk about how it's like building some base of strength and how important it is, and their climbing is suffering, but somehow they're like justifying it. And you know, if you tell me like that all you care about is being a well-rounded athlete and you are doing this for longevity and everything, fine. Like, first of all, like, make sure you're not lying to yourself, you know, like, and you really believe that. Then second, then don't conflate that with being the best climber you can be, which is kind of what I'm into. And maybe my tune will change if I'm 60 years old, you know, and that's fine. Yeah. Like, but don't lie. And don't be careful what kind of story you're telling yourself. Like, oh, I know my climbing's not getting better, even though all of my numbers went up in squatting, benching, and deadlifting. It's like, well, maybe it's not working.
Yeah. And that's all right. If that is you, that's, in my opinion, that's totally all right, because it's very complex to, like, if you ever have a conversation with a good coach out there, like, a good coach will tell you, honestly, in my opinion, a good coach should just tell you and just agree with you and just be like, yeah, it's very complicated. It's very difficult. And that's what gets really confusing, is something that you said that I really relate with, is like, something that works for somebody might work for some, you know, something that doesn't work for somebody, it actually might work for somebody else. You know, like, maybe I have an athlete that I don't totally tell them, like, yeah, you should squat a ton. And then Vale sees this and he's like, dude, what's going, why am I not squatting? Like, you don't think I'm going to be the best or something? I'm like, no. Absolutely not. So he would never ask that question, but you can see that some people might feel like that, right? It's like, whoa, you've prescribed this plan to somebody. And like, why did you do that? And it's like, I could tell you exactly why. Actually, I do the math, right? I see what they're weak in, what they don't feel. So what you're saying is, it makes a lot of sense. If you gain something, you don't just gain the pros of it, you gain the cons. If you do train, you're going to gain some weight for sure. But is that weight going to help the math? Is that weight matter here? Like, and that's a question that I've been studying for, like, I told you, or I told the podcast at some point a long time ago, that I started running one time for a sport climbing season for the IFS, for the World Cups, and I gained 15 pounds in like a couple of months. And I was like, wait, all right. So the amount
what kind
that
of
I
running
gained,
are you doing, Tim? Like, what,
well, because I had never run. Works. It's because I had never run. And so my base, I guess I realized that maybe I want the cardio, maybe I want the cardiovascular health, and I want that type of thing. And so I started rowing, I started doing like other things, just like higher intensity things that got my heart rate increasing. But I didn't really want to run because I had no leg muscle and I didn't really feel like I needed that leg muscle. And again, I'm not saying that you should follow that. I'm just saying that that was a decision I made for myself, that I said I didn't want that leg weight for the amount of work that it took and the gains that I felt and saw. And so, and I'm just explaining that thought process to say, like, for me, that's the pros and the cons, weighed them out, and I decided I didn't really want to do them. And you can't find that out until you get the results and then you look at them afterward, which is why like results-based things are important to look at, but we don't rely on them.
Well, this takes me back to your critique of me on reading routes and not being neutral. It's like, okay, I'm going to try weightlifting. Okay. Do I like what it did or not? And just being careful not to drink the Kool-Aid, because maybe it was super important for you. Maybe it was. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe it hurt you. But just be honest. And something you said, and I just want to nip this comment up, bud, because it's something that really irks me, is people will say, you don't have to gain weight from weightlifting. You gain weight by eating more food. Right? It's like, this is true. Like, if you just start weightlifting a bunch and then you stop eating, no, you will not gain weight. You will just die. Like, right. You know, so yes, if you do not up your calorie content, and perhaps if you, you know, even lower your protein, like, yes, physiologically they're right. But the reason why it's such ridiculous advice is I, as a weightlifter, as someone who has done powerlifting and really enjoys it, you get hungry because you've done damage to your muscles. You've stressed yourself, and what your muscles are aching for is nutrients so that they can grow bigger. It's hypertrophy. It's that same thing I was just talking about with, you know, training, bring yourself down from 100% and then your body tries to go to 101%. And it's the worst advice ever to someone to say, hey, go weightlift a bunch, don't eat more, and everything's okay. It's like the people who say this often in the same sentence, they will critique the whole thing in climbing, where we have issues with eating disorders and, you know, that weight isn't everything. And so I agree. I do not encourage people to starve themselves and focus on weight loss, and that you do need to fuel training and you do need to fuel training for adaptions. But then you can't go and say, now go weightlift, and if you gain muscle, it's your fault because you ate more food. It's like that. It just doesn't logically connect. So I just wanted to nip that comment in the bud, because I can't stand when people say go weightlift and it's your fault for gaining weight because you ate more food. Mm. It's the worst advice ever to have someone put a massive stressor on their body and then tell them to not eat more. They're just going to get injured or be unhappy or, well, I don't know. Just yeah. Anyways, rant. Rants on rants. Okay. Okay. Tim, can we put a pin in that and keep on moving forward? Didn't see that coming when I was doing my little notes for today, Tim, but that's how we do. Okay. A few announcements here, really quick announcements. Classroom number 11. Oh, Tim, classroom number 11 and 12 coming up, because Tim has taken the reins for the classroom. Tim says, you know what? Classrooms are so fun. I'm going to do more of them. And part of this is because we get tons of notes from people who are, well, actually a lot of them are international, and they say, hey, thanks for putting that at a time where it's the middle of the night. I'm not going to make it. And so Tim is adding, he has two classrooms scheduled. There's one on Saturday, the 18th at noon Pacific Standard Time, and a more classic one at our normal time on Wednesday, the 22nd at 7 p.m. also Pacific Standard Time. So hopefully you guys can make one of those now that we're adding in another. Thank you, Tim, for pushing that forward and doing a time that's hopefully accessible to more people. But if you can't make either of those, we also have the recordings for our lower tier patrons. And so you should join us. You should ask Tim the questions. But if you can't, or if you don't want to, I don't know why you wouldn't want to, but if for some reason that's not in the cards, you can still get the recordings by being a lower tier patron, and we would love to have you there, but love for you to join the community in whatever capacity makes sense for you.
Yeah. Just a couple of things on that announcement. Thanks, Josh, for sharing that for me. But I apologize for the late scheduling of the stuff. I would have loved to make it easy, but just on the road for the last couple of weeks. But this is going to be a regular thing. I'm going to do two classrooms a month, just pretty much for good. So if you guys can't make it, it's too soon for you guys, that's totally okay. Join on the next month. The Patreon will be the same as it kind of always is. So if you're already on the Patreon or you're currently a patron, then that will stay the same. But I'm going to change it to a personal one starting June. And just for some transparency, is because I would love to take these classrooms over. So Josh will still be there when he wants to be, when he can be. But I'm going to change kind of the formatting of the classrooms as well to be a little bit more back and forth, a little bit more involved. What we usually do is just answer the questions, but take it and turn it into, it's almost like a mini podcast. That's not what I want to do. I would love to have it actually be a classroom where we can maybe do some assessments with people and everyone can watch, or we can ask questions more back and forth and have conversation about it. And you guys can ask me, multiple questions at once. It's also just, again, to be transparent, it's a good way to support me. That this is something that I am passionate about. It's something that I really like, but historically I've not been interested in doing it because I don't think it is worth my time. It never made money. And so if this is a good way to go back and forth, you guys support me, I support you guys, this is a really good deal for you guys. And it's fun. It's just a good environment. So get on there.
Tim, you no longer coach people in general or even have AMAs. So if you want access to Tim, this is the only way. Tim, I will still join the classrooms, but I'm going to just bring a little glass of wine and just kind of sit back and ask my own questions. Now, I do really enjoy them. I love the excitement you bring. And so, I like that you called out that you're going to be moving it to your Patreon. And I just am excited to see what you do with it. I think we've done a good job with them thus far, but clearly there was a lot of people and excitement to be had that we weren't supporting. So I just appreciate you taking it that one next step further. And so now I'll be there. I'm excited too. And our first one, the first kind of, what did we say? It's on the 18th. Okay. 18th at noon, Saturday, the 18th at noon, and see y'all there. Okay, Tim, do you want to do your pro tip before we go into the topic of the day? I did my
topic of my day. Kind of the pro tip is like right after that, so I'll bring it up later.
Ooh, okay. Okay, good. So Tim, as we mentioned, you were in Salt Lake City. You're watching the NACS and the World Cup. Well, you watched them on the live stream, but you also got to see all these athletes in person. I know you were at the TC, where the comp was held. You were doing a training camp with some of your athletes who had competed. You saw some of the stars of our sport, talked to them, climbed with them or around them. And, you know, you're a pro, Tim. You're a coach. You've competed at these World Cups. It may have been a minute since you've seen them. And so I just kind of want to know what you noticed about these top competitors. You know, what stood out in those athletes? And I want you to name names.
So, a couple of things there. So around May time every year for the last couple of years, Salt Lake has been like a crazy buzz. You know, you go to any gym during this time near the World Cups and it's just crazy. Actually, I'm surprised not more people just like go and hang out. Last year or the year before, there was like a lot of people that I had coached previously. They were like, oh, like you're like, what's up? I'm like, what are you doing here? It's like, we're just here for the World Cup. It's like, it's awesome energy. I think with the Olympics this year, there was quite a few less big names, just quite a few less competitors in town because of the timing for them to train. So like Yanya wasn't there, like, you know, a lot of pretty strong competitors maybe weren't there. Some of the, in my opinion, like the goated competitors were still there and I got to watch them for the first time in person, which was awesome. But yeah, otherwise, like the energy was just crazy. Yeah, you go to the
name
gym.
Name names, Tim. I want you to name.
Yeah, I will.
Who are those people? Okay.
But going to the gyms, man, is crazy. Like I had a training session with Vail. I went to Bouldering Project and like, I was going to do a couple of rounds where I did like mock competition rounds. It's kind of crucial for the gym to be slightly empty because you usually give them 4 minutes, but if you pull on once and then you have like two or three people go during that time, and you know, you're supposed to like, when you're sessioning, you're supposed to take like a couple minutes off, but not when you're competing, you don't have a couple minutes off. You're supposed to go rapid fire, like or not necessarily rapid fire, but you only have 4 minutes to go. And when I tell you there was like probably 40 World Cup competitors in Bouldering Project sessioning like a couple days before the World Cup event, I was like, dude, this is insane. I was like, well, scratch this, Vail, just like, let's just climb with these guys. Like, my other guy I was coaching, Abram, was also there, and I was just like, guys, let's just try to do a round, but also like, if you see something cool, you know, I really think that it's just better to have the energy shared, watch beta, like share the mind with these other competitors. And it was crazy. I mean, I think Slovenian team was there, like German team was there. There's a bunch of really strong athletes there during that session alone. Then the World Cup happened. I mean, I'm sure you guys watched the World Cup. I can assume that if you guys are listening to this. But if you hadn't, then kind of classic results. I think Serato and Natalia won. I guess we could talk about speed too. Emma and Sam Watson are both just cracked at speed and, you know, just putting down insane times, but they also won, which is exciting. I think that was Emma's first gold medal, which is awesome. And Sam Watson just on fire. I don't think he ran above a 5 second time. Maybe you could clarify that, but I don't think he ran above a 5 second time, at least in the final. And then the World Cup happened. Yeah, I got to watch it and it was cool. And I had my own thoughts on the whole event and I kind of shared that a little bit in the beginning of the pod. But after the World Cup happened, there was an opportunity for the TC to be open. And this was just 2 days ago at the time of this recording. It was just 2 days previous. And we got an opportunity to go and join them at the TC. We didn't know that. They just like happened to open it up. And a couple of the finals climbs were up. So they got to work them together. And yeah, first thing we walk in and we see like a lot of the strong Japanese guys, Tomoa, Yoshiyuki, Serato were all there. And I was like, oh, I was literally, I don't fangirl about anybody. And I wasn't necessarily fangirling with Serato, but I was like, oh, sensei. Like I was just like whispering to Vail. I was like, that's sensei right there. And I say it specifically that way, not like, oh my God, it's Serato. Like I don't say it like that. I say it's like, that's sensei. Like watch him climb. Like he is the GOAT right now. Like watch him. But then Toby was there. And I have also said on this podcast, like, I think Toby Roberts is like one of the best climbing competitive athletes I've ever seen. And Jakob Schubert was there, man. Like Jakob is just like a beast. I mean, he's like getting older. He's like probably like near twice the age of some of these guys. Like it's kind of crazy. And the session was pretty I guess normal. I don't know. I've definitely, yeah, I have, when Ross and I had the YouTube channel, like we had, we had some sessions in Europe with a lot of these guys. So it wasn't totally unique for me to session with really, really strong competitive climbers. Did you find the age?
Yeah. You knew I was looking that up.
Yeah.
33.
Dang, dude. That's crazy. Like, he looks so strong. But yeah, I mean, I've had sessions with even Jakob before. I've warmed up in isolation with Jakob before. And even back then, he was still, for me, pretty freaky to watch, but not that absurd. I would say, like, for, I don't know, maybe because the level difference at, for me right now, based on my standard, is like pretty far off, that it was hard for me to compare it. But comparing him to watching him with like Vail, the kid that I coach, Dylan Countryman, who's a really strong US athlete, every other US athlete that was in the TC at that time, and Serato and Toby and Jakob pulling on the same wall. We were mostly climbing on the spray wall after we sessioned the finals boulders. But I don't think they sessioned them as much. But we were climbing on the spray wall. And yeah, first thing I noticed, it was kind of emptier at first because I wanted Vail to, you know, the finals boulders were very busy. And I was like, oh, I wanted some time with Vail to climb on the spray wall. And Serato was also there. And it was pretty much just like me, Vail, Serato, and a couple other climbers. And I was like, oh, this is my opportunity to like watch him on more normal style climbing. I hadn't really seen him on. And I shared one time on the Beat Pump podcast that the only other time I had like a comparison with Serato was watching videos of him post this like brown tag dyno at Beat Pump, which is three grades from the hardest grade, and a couple other green and green tags that he did. And I got to try them, and I couldn't even hang the position of the dyno that he like jumped to on this brown tag. And I hadn't seen another video of somebody doing this climb, so it definitely was not a brown tag. But that was like the only other thing that I'd seen even on like normal style climbing. Cause like, and I say normal because like we were talking about the comp style, like it's a lot of tricks. It's a lot of gimmicks. It's a lot of like, you know, jumping, sliding. And, but for me, the way that I interpret climbing is like mechanics, is strength, endurance, like technique, all of that. And so to see somebody on a spray wall is really where I can see their ability to read, their ability to make up climbing movement. And he was mostly circuiting. And the thing I told Josh on the phone, I was like, this guy, I said, there's two main factors that stood out to me in all of these guys, actually, but specifically in Serato watching him. Positions. His ability to pick positions, find the most ideal positions, not even like, it didn't look like he was solving for them. He just like intuited that like some positions were just better. And I'm talking about like leans on the wall, twisting, turning, where when he puts a foot on, like what he is leaning more onto. I talk a lot about when I coach climbers, I look at a lot of bias. Like if you're pulling into if you have this left foot and you're pulling with your right hand, which one's working more and why is that important? Well, I study that, but there's also just watching climbers who are really good at it do it very effectively, right? It's two different things for me. And I'm like, wow, I'm like now basing a lot of my information off of watching him, right? Because I'm like, well, it's just so effective. It's just, I have to watch it. And it's just so effective. So positions were the first one that I noticed, and hand strength. And I don't say finger strength. I say hand strength, because it's not necessarily a bunch of crimps on this wall. There's a bunch of slopers, pinches, like all sorts of weird holds. And when you're climbing really hard stuff, like not just like double digit boulders, really hard stuff, not just like 514s, like really hard climbing. And I can't even give it a grade necessarily, because it's not like any of these things are graded, but just like you can tell it's really hard climbing. It's very complex. There's a lot of weird positions. There's a lot of factors that might cause failure, like weird slipping or like really just hard. Like, and Josh knows what I'm talking about. It's hard to describe this stuff, but sometimes difficult climbing is more in like the experience of what you're doing on the wall versus the movements themselves. And the hand strength required, I think, to climb well on the spray wall is absurd. You know, like the friction sometimes on these holds is like not very ideal. Some of these holds are all over the place, very whack. The direction of where your hands have to be in order to do some of these movements that these guys are doing is very complex. And so being comfortable, you know, open handing, full crimping, half crimping, pinching weird, like pinching sideways, grabbing a sloper engaged with your fingers engaged or open handed. There's different utility for these things. And these guys have everything on lock. Like, and I don't just say Serato. I mean, Jakob, Tomoa, Meichi, whoever I was watching, I was like, wow, positions are on lock and hand strength is on lock. And a secondary to that, I don't know if you want to take it from there.
I don't want to stop I can just see your eyes glazing over as you're sitting on the spray wall watching Serato do his thing. The thing that struck me about this when we talked about it was positions, hand strength. I think the reason why it really struck me is because what we typically say is power and finger strength. I would say that's how it's commonly phrased. And why this really stood out to me is when you said positions, especially, is I thought that it was, I mean, we know about positions. We know position is super important. Of course we talk about that. But I think what stuck in my head is that you said, like when they get to these positions, it's just a little bit better. Like they go a little bit further. Like it's just that extra little lean to, you know, it's like, oh, you want to make that side pull better? Make it, you know, use it like a side pull, but then really committing to that. And it made me think of, this is some of the subtlety of quote unquote strength that I think people don't quite understand what strength is, where it's like, oh, wow, you can do a pull up with like 50 kilos on you or something. But where you see the strength lie in these amazing athletes is like that ability to actually get into that position. You may know that you want to lean into something, but there's a physicality there and a commitment, and it goes hand in hand. And yeah, I know we're not the ones who always want to harp on strength, but there is a strength to obtaining those positions, but then there's also a commitment and understanding of it and how that all weaves together. Yeah. So I wanted to share that part of what the positions kind of, why that stood out in my head.
Sure. Yeah, no, that to me was like the most important factor was when I was explaining this to Josh, it all kind of like, it hit me. So this for me is like just happened. And, you know, yeah, I digest climbing, like I digest everything, you know, the whole experience, the competition, like just being there in that environment, coaching Vail, watching these climbers. And I was like, wow, like this is a lot to take in. The biggest thing I took in was what I was trying to say to Josh was like, these aren't the most complex discoveries in climbing. They're actually far from that. You know, people know that positions matter a lot in climbing. People know that hand strength matters a lot in climbing. It's kind of what Josh was just saying. But the thing that makes the difference in great athletes versus good athletes is how much they trust that, how good they are at relying on that, how often they believe in it, when they pick it. Like it's all those little factors. And I want to, before I move on from that or kind of continue going down that thread, I want to say one thing that's really important. Is that there is much, much more to these athletes than what I just am talking about. These are the most crucial things that I noticed. So I don't want to talk about everything else that makes these athletes great right now. It was just crazy to me that those are the two things that stood out because they were, for me, extremely simple. I was like, wow, like, why is that the only thing that I'm noticing? That's the kind of the point that I'm trying to make, is that there are a lot of other things that I do feel already about them. Specifically, I'm talking specifically about Toby and Serato, because I have kind of stated before on the podcast that I think that they're some of the best climbing athletes in, at least in competition climbing. There are many, many other factors that I think are really good, but it was crazy to me that I realized what provides them consistency in great results, and just like something that brings them beyond the common thread, I think is really what I'm trying to point out, is it's the same thing that everybody is doing. It's just how much reliance they have on it. And it's the right thing, in my opinion. And it might not be just my opinion, it might be theirs as well. And just to see them rely on it over and over again, constantly, I was like, this is fascinating to me. Just like how it's such a simple thing, but they're just so good at it, you know? And like, yeah. And actually, this is going to bring up my pro tip, but I can share it after.
Yeah, let's keep on going with this, because I think it goes back to some of the stuff we've talked about over the course of the podcast, where the fundamentals are the fundamentals because they are fundamental. And the thing about doing a drop knee is that there's just these levels of doing a drop knee that people don't appreciate. It's not it, like maybe first you learn it. It's like, oh, this is a new technique and it sucks my hips into the wall. And then you can just go down that forever. And when you see people climbing well, in some ways it's super basic. The one I often like talking about is when you flag, and then people will flag and they don't straighten their leg. And so when you flag, you're trying to provide a counterweight, something that, let's just keep it simple. You're trying to provide a counterweight. And the longer your lever is, the more of a counterweight it will be. So a flag will be more effective when you straighten your leg and point your toe. And so when you see people flag that are really good, they're just flagging, but every little part of it is done to perfection. And what it comes down to is in some ways, the metric that we should all be looking for, well, correct me if you think I'm wrong in this, Tim, is using technique that makes the move actually as easy as possible. So rather than being as strong as you can be for the move, you try to make the moves as easy as possible. And it's an infinite exploration, even in some of the most basic things around hanging plumb, finding the right body position. And because climbing is so dynamic and it's just, you know, this is a rabbit hole we could go down forever, but hearing what you said is, it's just like, it's the position that they're doing the position, but to the, so to the degree, to a professional degree. Yeah. So go ahead, pick me apart.
Almost. I agree. Almost. Yes. If you are trying to get something done and there is a technical aspect to it, what you should be focusing on is wherever you are in your athletic journey, if you are at a place where you understand those techniques and you've worked those fundamentals and you even can define the language of it, you should only be thinking. And if you were before that, you should just be understanding, you know, should be studying, you know, finding as much information as possible, like really looking for fundamentals and, you know, trying to learn them, get a coach. But if you're at that place where you do know techniques and you're good at them, what you should be doing in trying to perform the technique is be thinking about what gets that technique done the best. I wouldn't say the easiest way to do movement. I would say the best way to do the movement, because often what I've learned in my climbing over the course of time is that sometimes the best way to do something is looking for the easiest way in terms of the lowest amount of effort, physical effort output. But sometimes that actually isn't. And we don't have to go down that rabbit hole, but I would just tweak that language to say everything exactly what you said, but the best way to use those mechanics.
So I'm curious. I don't have a problem with that pushback. I mean, I just know I'm always right, Tim, so I don't mind when you disagree. Yeah. No, I want to keep on teasing this out because it is important, the language that we use, because we're trying to explore this thing and communicate with each other and understand what's going on there. And I guess what I want to understand with what you mean there is that sometimes when I'm doing the correct technique, something that may look basic, whether it's a drop knee or a heel hook, I have to try unbelievably hard in this way that isn't exactly just pulling strength. I have to like set my body in this position that doesn't quite, I'm not used to it, but I know it's the right technique. And so in some ways it feels harder because it's maybe just, it's an all over body experience where I'm focusing on every little bit and trying to find this position. It's really exhausting, but it's like, I think it's the easiest. It's like the easiest way in the sense of, I don't know if, yeah, this is where easy is a tricky word. Okay. Yeah. That's all I got. Anyway, so go ahead.
Have you ever, this is a dumb question, but have you ever swung a golf club like onto a golf ball, like specifically, like, you know, try to, or correctly, like not just for like shits and giggles, but like,
more for shits and giggles, but maybe I've tried once or twice, but it's been maybe 20 years.
If you, my girlfriend's dad is like quite, he's pretty good at golf, and he's helped me a lot. And I enjoy golf. It's pretty fun. I'm not good at golf. But I've enjoyed a couple of times going to the driving range. And so if you guys golf, you'll know exactly what I'm trying to talk about. If you try to a golf swing, you haven't golfed, but a golf swing is quite simple, right? In terms of mechanics. Right. Mm-hmm. Just like in terms of face value, you're like, yeah, golf swing is super simple. You just swing back and you swing forward. And then you start to notice, and this is for me, like every time I've done it, I'll have to like, you know, correct the swing in a million different ways. And the swing will never be consistent. Sometimes I'll miss the ball and I'll be like, my left arm was supposed to stay straight the whole time. Shit. Okay. Swing back. It's like, my hips moved too far back. Oh, my hips went too far forward. It's like, dude, you're just swinging a golf club. You ever shot a basketball, Josh?
Yes.
Yes. Shooting a basketball, quite a simple mechanic, right? You just, and this is the common one when you're taught to shoot a basketball, you throw it, and you keep your hand up there in the cookie jar. Why do they tell you to do that? Because they're trying to have you do all of the mechanic properly. Well, going from like a climbing movement to me being very, very complex and many, many factors to like a golf swing being a bit simpler, but like I would say the factors have much more fluctuation to the result if you have even the slightest degree of change. And it's something like a basketball throw, which is like arguably a very, very simple mechanic, but why is Steph Curry so much better than everybody else at shooting damn basketball, right? And so when you start to understand mechanics in that way, where you're like, well, a simple mechanic can be simple, but the tweaks that I have to make that actually amount to a result that I want to have, man, if you just heel hook just a little bit wrong in height, in the momentum, in no momentum, in where your other foot is, where your hand is, you know, what direction your toe is facing, like what rubber you have on, what friction the hold has. Like if you start to take in all of those factors and then try to perfect simple technique, you'll realize how hard it is to do that. And so when we're talking about Serrato and I'm watching him do this gas stone and then he leans left and matches it, I'm talking about him doing that perfectly. I'm talking about watching a golfer swing a golf club and I'm like, wow, like I even might understand how to swing a golf club. And I'm like, that guy's damn good at it, you know? And like, and yeah, the level at climbing that even I'm at watching Serrato climb, I'm like, holy, like what? Like, how did he do that on that position? Like the wall's overhung and that hold is not in cut and these feet are so bad. And like, how is he doing that? And it's not necessarily shocking to me. I get it. You know, it's just like, well, how does he do it every time? At this difficulty, with this insecurity level, with the pressure in the environment here, with the conditions, like all of it, every factor that I can think of, I'm like, wow, how does he do that consistently? And that's why I really bring out these like simple things, you know?
Sometimes the beta that I've used on myself, but also to other people, is super trite, but it works. It's actually do the beta that you're trying to do. So you're talking about a gas stone. It's like, oh, I have a gas stone and I'm kind of barn dooring off. Okay, lean into it. It's like, oh, I know, Tim, I was fucking leaning into it. It's like, no, that's all I want you to think about. Like, how can you just, you know, it's a gas stone. You know, you need to lean into it. Do everything you can and really commit to that. And then oftentimes that has resolved cruxes for me where I'm doing the beta. I'm like, dude, I'm putting my foot here. It's like, no, I need you to really commit to what you think is that basic mechanic. And it's something that we've talked about where that's helped me, you know, your advice, like, okay, things are getting really complex. Yeah. But what's the one thing, Josh? Like, what's the one thing? Yeah. So we can keep on going to this, but you said something else about this experience that I think segues perfectly from this. You said that, I don't know if you can make me bleep this out later if you want me to, but you said that Vail was climbing with Serrato or, you know, next to him. And he said to you or to himself, like, oh, wow, like I'm not that far off. Like I'm here next to one of the best in the world and I'm not that far off. And I wanted to, you see how that's kind of like a segue where, you know, you're doing a move and it's basic, but he's doing, and like you get on the move and you're like, I don't know, like it's, I see it. I wanted to tie that in because I think it both shows how obtainable greatness is, but also what it actually means to obtain greatness and how that small divide is an ocean, but also it's there. And you know, and also what that what you talk to Vail, if we can use his name, what you talk to him about to understand, help him grok how that journey might go and what to focus on.
Yeah. First of all, I don't mind having Vail's name in there because I actually could just only see that as a compliment. And that's because I'm his coach, because I have control over then what do you do with that ocean of a divide, you know, like, because for some people it might be, and for some others it might not be. And so I comfortably can say that not everybody, even though everybody has the tools and the opportunities, could have the opportunities, maybe. Most people could have the same opportunities to the path to greatness. Most people won't get there. Most people who even have that. What I'm trying to say is most people who even have the same opportunities probably won't get there. And there's going to be reasons. And that's kind of what we're talking about. Mm-hmm.
Can I clarify something super quick? I think what strikes me so much there is that Vail is really good, amazing up and coming climber. And where Vail is at though is obtainable by a lot. There's a lot of people who are listening who are very strong and who are good climbers. And I just think they might be shocked how, if they were climbing next to Serrato, how they might be like, wow, like Serrato's strong. I'm strong too. And just like, I think it's good for people to know how good they actually are. And it's also good to know that the difference between what makes someone great and what makes someone good is maybe not what we're what people often tell you, which is squatting. Basically, Serato can squat 700 pounds is what you're going to tell me. Is that it?
Just definitely kidding. Not. Yeah. Just kidding. I will actually say that both times you just kind of painted that picture is actually the best way to look at it, is that I think Vail is actually an incredible athlete in terms of raw physical attributes, technical attributes, and the brain that has performance. I would say what it probably took for him to get there from, he just turned 18. That's his age. And I will say probably from now on, he'll probably regularly, unless I have something to say about it, but in my current state, he'll beat me in almost every competition. He's very good. Yeah, he's won a fair amount of competitions. He's done quite a few, you know, high level competitions, even at his young age. And I would say that from the moment he started climbing, to get him to where he's gotten now is kind of the same answer as like, what does it take to get him from where he is right now to get to like Serato's ability, which is crazy because it's like, well, but he's clearly had, you know, from where he started to where he is now, there's like huge, it's like, yeah, but it's what you're saying. It's like, but as you get better and better at things, as you start getting to a higher level, it becomes much more about the specifics and how often do you rely on the specifics? How much in those heated moments do you rely on those versus the other things? It's all of the littlest things. Like the littlest things make the most major adjustments at the highest level of the game. And so the way that I see it is, depending on your mental state, depending on your level of desire, depending on your work ethic and your drive, yes, everybody is capable of getting to like a Serato level, given that they have, you know, their other fundamentals in place, which then is just a matter of making a lot of decisions to put yourself in an atmosphere to train and to provide that. But once you get to that level, it takes an enormous amount of sensitivity to be able to tweak the dials on all the things that you need to work on. And just to like, and I know Vail, if Vail listened to this, like he would know in our journey of, I think we've worked together for about 2 years now. And in the 2 years that we have worked, I think very few of our conversations have been about physical things. They've almost all been about mental, tactical, and like, yeah, just reaction-based things. It's just like, well, how do you feel about this? Like, what do you think about this? Like, because those are the things that alter your view on what is important. You know, and my goal with him is to not tell him, hey, Vail, look at what I think is important and you should do what I think is important. It's just to ask him, what do you think is important? And challenge him and say, like, I don't think that's right, man. Like, and this is the conversations Vail and I argue more than I've ever argued with anybody. And that's because I'll tell him something that I think and I'll just basically challenge what he thinks. Not because I think that I am better than him or I'm more right than him. It's just because I'm challenging that what he's saying is not coming from a neutral place. And that's what I think it takes for him specifically to get to the level of like Serato, because it's not going to come in these physical things, because we can prove literally that they're pretty close, right? And so that's really the interesting thing to me, is that because you have physical things that are very similar, where on paper, if you have a session where there's not too many factors that will take potentials away from you, like in an environment, like in a competition, there's a lot of things that might take away physical potential, right? But in an environment like a TC spray wall session, especially after a World Cup, there might not be that many factors that take away physical potential. So you'll probably see it on the wall. And so because of that, you're like, wait, what? Like I climb the same level of this guy. I've seen this so many times in climbing, man. I've seen so many people be like, yeah, wait, I'm not that far. Like, yeah, I climb that. It's like, well, so what is the difference? That's the way I see it. It's not so much to say like, oh, there's not that many differences. It's no, there are differences. There's a lot less of them than you think, but what are those differences? Why don't you have them? Like, why aren't you working on them? And they're mostly mental. They're mostly decisions. They're mostly like the small things that happen consistently over time.
I want to bring this into the realm of mere mortals and show that it's all kind of the same. And because I'm sure everyone has had this experience where they've climbed with someone who they thought was incredible. And then it could be like, it doesn't have to be a professional, just like, wow, I saw that person flash my bouldering project in Bishop. And then you climb with them on the spray wall and you think like, what the heck? Like, why am I, what's going on here? And I want to share, I want you to pick apart something in my head that has happened that I'm kind of curious if this is part of that whole mentality in these little getting these little decisions right all along the way. And it has to do with some of the things we've talked about, where when I've recommended this because it's something that's worked for me, is when I get scared, when I get pumped, when I get doubtful, I like to focus on I know you often like saying that, you know, beta is the thing to do, mechanics is the way to get it done. Mm-hmm. And so for me, when I get in this mentality, it's a negative mentality, and I start kind of grasping at things that don't actually help me get up the wall, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's negative self-talk, whether it's fear, whether it's thinking about the external outcome versus the moment. And so I've dived deeper into saying, yeah, but how do I get this next move done? You know, like, you know, is this the kind of stuff that, you know, is that an example of something that
yeah.
maybe, you know, Serato is doing when all eyes are on him, when he has to send this move to get gold? What he's trying to do is that mm-hmm. move and find that position rather than be like, I'm going to crimp even harder on this. Like, could we right. explore some of those specific yes. things?
Yes. Yes, but I also want to kind of relate personally as well, because I see it much more how you just kind of painted that picture personally. And maybe this, you guys can see the corollary. If you know me as a professional athlete, where I have decided to explore my mind in climbing is by providing consequence. And I actually almost needed that. That could be up for discussion, but in my opinion, I almost needed consequence to be there, to not to bring them out of me, not to bring out that mindset out of me, or the system in place to like rely on the right things. I was very much like you, where like when things started to go wrong, or like things started to feel not so good, I would rely on things that probably didn't really actually amount to a better result. And so to answer what your question was, is that is what Serato is doing day in, day out, every situation, no matter if his security is questioned or not in terms of like mental insecurity. I could see it being really difficult to defend his position as a rock climbing athlete, because he's quite a bit smaller than I think most people think. He's like, doesn't look like your traditional climber. He's not super shredded. And if you see a powerful movement, I would assume that he would feel a little bit insecure right away, but he doesn't show that. And I don't think he thinks that. I literally think his thought process is either primed, taught, or he's taught himself to just be like, what's the best thing to do? Boom, bang, do that. I needed consequence to do that. Personally, I needed to be like, all right, dog, well, do the V5 at 40 feet in the air. Now how you're going to do it perfectly. That's literally what highballing is for me. Highballing for me was, oh, you think you know climbing? All right, put yourself at the stakes where if you don't do it right, you're not just going to hurt yourself, but you might die. That was required for me to like really think about that process that way. And I think I've had a lot of conversations about like how this highball experience, my entire climbing highball experience has affected me. And it's because like I actually was more interested in that aspect of climbing than the consequence aspect of climbing. You know, I actually did get scared on a lot of the stuff. And I actually did have like, I don't know if regret's the right word, but I wasn't super happy with how much the gravity of the consequences could have been if they happened. But I kind of needed that for us, you know, and maybe you guys can see the corollary there. It's funny because my laughing. Pro tip. Yeah, yeah.
No, please hold on 1 second, because I'm laughing. I'm like, is this going to be Tim's pro tip? Is, well, you need to work on your mechanics by risking your life. There you go. Like, you'll get better mechanics if you put your life online. Please do not make that your pro tip. We have impressionable young minds out there.
No. Yeah. And hopefully like this doesn't come off in the wrong way, you know, at all. This is just very honest for me. Like I really liked highballing because, I was really interested to see what I would do. And to be fair, if my mom is listening or whatever, not that I care, about that, but, I felt very safe every time I highballed. I felt very comfortable with the amount of testing and the amount of research that I went into, given that mindset, given that approach where I'm like, okay, I'm going to commit myself to this highball. I'm going to acknowledge the consequence. I don't want to die. I don't want to hurt myself. So what does that take? What amount of knowledge, what amount of physical strength, what amount of technique do I need to have in lock? What shoe I need to have? What condition do I need to have? I asked and answered all those questions to a degree that I was comfortable with. And so I don't have, you know, I don't need to defend that to somebody because that's how I approached it. And I would urge you, if you want to go in that path, to at least have those prerequisites, because that will make you, at least to a degree that you can control, safe. My pro tip actually is remember that your heroes are human. It's funny because it's what you were just saying. Remember that your heroes are human, and don't dismiss them as human or not just because of the gifts or the talent that you see. And it's kind of what we're talking about with Serato. Hopefully I've done a good job in saying both things, that I think Serato is sensei, man. Like, I think he, for me, is someone I look up to. He's someone that I see as absolutely incredible. And for the sake of Serato, like Jakob and Toby and those guys, like, I would love to climb with them, and I would love to push myself as an athlete to, like, one day maybe beat them in competition. That would be awesome. But at the same time, I do look up to them. They're incredible rock climbers. They're some of the best that I've ever seen in person. And on the other side of that, they're just doing really important, simple things consistently every time. And it's not to say that that just makes them basic. It just means that everybody else isn't doing that. You know, that's the way that I see it. And so if you see your hero and you're like, I don't know, I just will never be that guy. Like, I'll just never be that girl. I'll never be that person. Like, that just seems highly unlikely. It's like, well, check your logic. You know, like, maybe you have no idea what even got them there, like what keeps them there and like what makes them consistently getting better. And if you try to do that too, who knows? They're just human. Serato was just born just like you, you know, like, and just like me. And that's how the way I've seen people in life my entire life. And because of that, I didn't want to pick up any arrogance necessarily. I just want to ask questions to be like, well, what got somebody there? And I think that's sometimes where people go maybe too hard in that direction, where it's just like, oh, people are just human. Like, I could be the goat too. It's like, no. You need to do the right work to be that goat.
Well, I think that the big thing that I take out of that pro tip is, when I think about guys like Serato, it's very easy to watch their movement and it looks great. And it looks simple, and you think that in their head, it's simple and easy, and you dismiss the literal physical effort as well as the mental effort of committing to the thing, having faith in their commitment, really going 110% towards that thing that they have developed, to recognize that it is the thing that they need to do for success. And so when I talked about my little experience about when I'm nervous or scared or pumped, and how my desire is to do things that are not going to actually help, when I talked about on the last podcast, we kind of talked about how I struggled with a negative self-talk in the middle of a rope climb, and I wanted to just give up. And then I just decided to kind of commit and do the beta. And if you had watched me, you would have seen none of that. You just been like, in fact, the guy who belayed me is like, dude, you walked that. Look freaking casual. Like, why don't we put you on something hard? But inside, I was going through all this stuff. And that's that whole, like, just because you see something doesn't mean you understand the commitment, the dedication to the craft, the tackling of the hard thing in their head every freaking time. And that's what you're seeing that looks easy. And yeah, I like you putting shining the light on that, man.
Yeah. I don't know if this is what everybody feels. And hopefully this podcast, this is like my attempt at, you know, sharing help for this podcast, is to like provide a bit of vulnerability for like what I actually experience and feel, but then also having this very critical view on like this high level in climbing. For me, and what I just heard from Josh is like, we got scared, man. Like, in our experiences in climbing, like, you're in this moment where like, maybe it's nerves, maybe it's insecurity or whatever, but honestly, at the end of the day, you're just scared that you're like not going to be able to do the thing. And so you react based on fear. And the reason why I shared the consequence thing for me is because then I showed myself what true fear was. I showed myself the difference between like what I thought I was afraid of and then what actual fear was, and just being like, I don't want to die. And then I stopped making bad decisions on those walls. I stopped. And so maybe for me, I don't want to accuse anybody of anything or like say what might be helpful for somebody, but for me, what I needed to do was to really understand what was causing fear for me and how to react properly. And for whatever reason, these kids aren't scared, man. Like, for whatever reason, they just do every time, they just do what they think is best. I don't think they're cocky either. I don't think they're overly confident. I just think they're not scared, you know, and sometimes they maybe. I think I've seen moments where even Serato, I'll watch him in competition and be like, there he looked, maybe he was scared. Maybe he was afraid to do something and then reacted rather than had a neutral view and said, what is the best thing to do? And reacted off that, because that's what he trains for. That's what he does all the time. But yeah, hopefully that provides some clarity for people.
Yeah, I love that thing. That's what he trains for, is it's that decision you make over and over again to choose the thing that I like to say it's that quiet voice that you need to follow, not the loud, nervous one. And I just want to point out that you can be, you know, I like that you broke it down into scared. And you can be scared for a whole bunch of reasons or uncomfortable. And so when we were climbing and we were doing a video, Tim, you know, I think like, oh, I'm getting recorded right now. How do I look while climbing? I'm the first one on this climb. I thanks, Doc. I need to flash it. Or Tim just flashed this, I need to flash it too. And then it was helpful for me to sit down and say, I'm just going to climb right now. Okay, where do I need to put my foot? And it sounds, I got a message from someone on Instagram, actually, Tim, saying that this stuff we're talking about really, really helped him. And that he was almost kind of, thought it was kind of ridiculous because it's so obvious. It's like, oh, focus on the climbing. And there's more to that. We just unpacked what focusing on the climbing means. That's a pretty general statement, but it's not obvious. And on top of that, it's not a given. And it's something that needs to be practiced day in and day out, so that when Serato is potentially on the last couple of moves to secure a gold medal in the Olympics, the biggest stage of anyone's career, that it's just, it's the same decision he's been making for the last decade.
Yeah. I have one piece of practical advice, given this conversation, because I'm sure, you know, people, I would feel very excited. I feel actually very excited even just right now after having this conversation to like go to the gym or something. But if this, hopefully this empowered you guys to believe in yourselves a little bit more, but, it's a complicated journey to improve and to progress. But my practical piece of advice would be the easiest way for this stuff to happen, in my opinion, with hopefully the knowledge and the wisdom that Josh and I have shared will guide you towards like making better decisions, like better, you know, technical or physical decisions. But beyond that, something that will help a lot, and that's something that helps me a lot, and something I actually have learned from Michaela, my girlfriend, is have fun, man. Like if you're not having fun, and I really mean this, like if you're really not having fun, you're gonna get too critical. You're gonna get scared. You're gonna react to these things. That for me is something that's a given. And there's a lot of ways to trick your environment into forcing you to have fun. You can have fun in the try hard. You can have fun in these insecure moments. You can have fun in those ways. You can have fun. That's why Josh and I have shared so many pro tips about like climb with your friends, like climb in this way, like talk about this stuff. It's actually because like when Josh and I climbed together, it was just pure fun. And yeah, there was a lot of heat. There was a lot of pressure. There was a lot of things that were going on. But man, like the reason why it was just such a good experience for both of us, I think it was because we were just having so much fun. And I walked away from that session mostly just seeing like all the things that I wanted to get better at, things, you know, I just felt a lot of desire to improve. And I think it was because I had a lot of fun. And so hopefully you guys can just go and have some fun and try hard.
That was fun. That was a blast of a session. I'm going to thank you for pro tip number two, Tim. I'm going to do pro tip number two that is almost like the opposite. I'm sure I could argue how these are connected and weave together. But as we were talking about this way to make the right decision, or this necessity to make the right decisions when things are scary, hard. You know, we say scary, but clearly that's not just means your life is on the line. You could be being watched by your gym crush. I don't know, whatever the case may be. But I realized, Tim, that the assumption we're making is that people are getting outside their comfort zone. And if you never are feeling like you're scared or you're on the hold that you're not comfortable with, then you don't even know what we're talking about. And yeah, that's a prerequisite. Is I find that stuff fun, and maybe you can build that into your practice of fun. Mm-hmm. Is make sure that you don't like rope climbing, like, well, maybe that's the best place for you to practice that self-talk we're talking we just mentioned. So yeah, make sure that you have those moments where you're scared. It doesn't have to be literally physically dangerous. Although boys, that work like a charm. But yeah, anyway, so that's my pro tip.
No, I like it. I like it a lot. No, that's actually super effective. Get out of your comfort zones, guys. Be gentle to yourselves, but try really hard, and then have fun. And hopefully you guys progress. And if you don't, join the classroom.
Join the classroom if you are progressing, because because we just keep that ball rolling. It's where you can ask these questions, and we're giving some basic framework. It's very easy to say, when you're uncomfortable, make the decision to climb better. But that's a very abstracted principle, and I think it's more useful. Well, it's useful, and this is what we can do in the platform that we're given. But it's why oftentimes when I talk to you, Tim, I ask the question, hey, Tim, I was in the middle of a climb and I started telling myself, I'm too pumped. There's no way I can do this. What about that, Tim? And so getting into those specifics, because the devil's in the details. We were just talking about how Serato does great positions on the Gastone. And so you could just say, oh, well, you just need to find the right position. But clearly there's a million layers there. And that's what Tim's an expert at. And so come join the classroom, sign up for Patreon and join the classroom on, was it the 18th? Why can't I remember this one, Tim?
Saturday. 18th at noon.
On Saturday.
Yeah. It's a Saturday. You guys have time at noon on Saturdays, right? Hopefully.
Yeah. Dude,
Wednesday.
Wednesday at 7 p.m. Nothing will get you more psyched than going in and talking. Like, do that before your session or after. But it's just fun to keep that psych going, because I always come out of those, I don't know, it's that community aspect, being around people who share that same love. So join us. We'd love to see you. And Tim, it was good seeing you, my dude.
It's good seeing you, my dude. I'll see you soon.
All right. Next time, man. Take care.
Take care.
Thanks for tuning in. If you'd like to learn more about Test Piece Climbing, you can check us out at testpiececlimbing.com and even book a session with one of our coaches.